That Armageddon, the vengeance of the Lord. Take us through chapters 14, 15, and 16. This is the fifth chapter in our series, and we'll begin in 14:1. And this is the English version I'll be using, English Standard. Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the roar of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing their harps. And they were singing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures, before the elders. No one can learn that song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. It is these who had not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. It's these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouth no lie was found, for they are blameless. Pausing right there, what kind of people are following in this first paragraph?
Faithful.
Mm-hmm. Faithful?
Faithful disciples. Virgins.
Not feminine?
Right.
They just had to be male to go to heaven, right? It stinks. So what does it mean? He describes them as Jewish males. Virgins, in fact. Well, normally with the business, whether it's warfare or anything else, among the tribes, it's contracted among the men. There's no awareness of the women being missing. These men have not defiled themselves with women. They've kept pure, faithful, and not compromised the covenant. Adultery is a frequent image of compromising one's faith. This isn't about sex. It's about holding on. They're truthful, absolutely truthful. I see another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on earth, through every nation and language and people. And he who said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs." Another angel, a second, followed, saying, Fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality. In Revelation, up to this point, who is the enemy of God's people?
Satan.
It is Satan.
Caesar.
Spiritual adulteries through Caesar. What kind of adultery did Caesar want us to commit?
Emperor worship.
Just want us to do what the government said about religion. Mm-hmm. Religion, tax. But ultimately, Satan was behind that whole thing.
Yeah.
A message to proclaim. And who should we fear? Fear Caesar? No, fear God. Because Fallen is Babylon the Great. Now, who's Babylon? Sure it isn't Poughkeepsie? Maybe it represents somewhere else.
Until 2 weeks ago, I always looked at Babylon as being pagan worship, as opposed to an entity, but an idea.
No, Babylon represents the pagans, mm-hmm. though it has an actual location, and there are a lot of Jews in Babylon. And he announced that Babylon's fallen. Well, the funny thing is, the getting ready for the war and the fight, that follows this. So, but even before they've had the war, the announcement goes out. They're calling the election results before the first tabulations are in.
Yeah.
It's not the way you do it. So it's overconfident. But we're getting that message early. The announcement of Babylon's fall. I want to ask this question once again. It says in verse 8, Babylon, who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality. Why sexual immorality? Why is that the accusation? Could it be that throughout the Bible, when we are lured away from true faith to God, that's considered to be adultery? We don't keep faith with God. It's like not keeping faith with someone you promised to marry. So that image comes back over and over. So many prophets talk about sexual. I'm trying to think of a prophet who doesn't talk about it.
Maybe Joel.
Yeah, maybe Joel. The point is, most of the prophets make use of that image over and over and over. So, biblical faithfulness. And then we have another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast, that's our previous class, receives a mark on his forehead or his hand, he also will drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and sulfur. In the presence of the holy angels, in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of the torment goes up forever and ever. They have no rest, day or night, these worshippers of the beast, and its image, and don't receive the marks of his name. Hold on. What kind of torment are we talking about here? So someone says, I'm not going to listen. I want those marks. I want to be a full participant in the economic life of the world. I don't think religion should make me behave differently economically. What kind of torment are we talking about?
It's just the daily struggles of life itself. Like, mm-hmm. you reap that. If you don't have a spiritual backing, then life is going to be life for you.
You don't seek God's wisdom. You just want to do it on your own.
Does that feel painful?
It did for me.
Did it feel like fire and sulfur?
Sounds like hell.
No rest day or night. The fire going up forever and ever.
Like a living hell?
Maybe a living hell? I mean, the problem is worshiping the beast. It's those who worship the beast. Now, I don't believe that this is... This could easily be giving us a false picture of who God is. Well, a lot of people like to take this verse out just like that and boil down all the passages about God to just a section like that. Forget God's love on the cross. Let's just look at his refusal to forgive here. Well, where else in the Bible do we read about smoke and sulfur?
Sodom and Gomorrah.
You know, Sodom and Gomorrah is a great passage. And it was destroyed because it was unfaithful. Mm-hmm. It's destroyed. And the smoke rises. And how did it put it in the text of Genesis 19? How long did the smoke rise in Sodom? Is it just one weekend? You don't remember about 40 days? Who's got Jude in his Bible?
Oh, we don't have Jude in the Bible.
We got a Bible, we got Jude.
You don't carry the Judeless Bible? Can you read Jude 7 for us?
Yes.
She's got an analog Judeful Bible. This is good. Mine's analog too, but if I shake it hard, it still doesn't come out.
Seven?
Yeah.
In a similar way, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding towns gave themselves up to sexual immorality and perversion. They serve as an example of those who suffer the punishment of eternal fire.
Great. That's a long time. So they suffered the example. Mm-hmm. What are they doing now?
They're not around.
they're not around. Because wherever you put them, the fires have stopped. Fires have stopped centuries ago.
Why does it say eternal fire?
So what is it? What does eternal mean?
More than a week.
Without end.
The memory of it.
Well, if something is eternal, the thing placed in it for burning will be thoroughly burned up. It'll burn until there's nothing more, right?
The effects of it are eternal. The effects of it are eternal.
The effects are eternal. In the New Testament, there are several examples of things with eternal effects, and others, the actions themselves are eternal. Mm-hmm. They're nonstop, as opposed to the effects being irreversible. So this is something that happened in the past. And Jude says this is a pretty good example for what that means. So are the people in Sodom still today conscious of what was going on? Or are they still being burned today for what happened then? I don't see any reason from this passage to conclude that. He says the smoke of the fire rises forever. Mm-hmm. Who has Isaiah? Who has Isaiah 34? Anyone over there in the blue shirts? This is the judgment on Edom.
What chapter?
34?
10.
34:10.
It will not be quenched night and day. Its smoke will rise forever. From generation to generation, it will lie desolate. No one will ever pass through it again.
Okay, so Edom is being destroyed. Smoke goes up, not just overnight, all the way till Tuesday, but it's going to keep forever and ever. And what else does it say about that passage?
Men shall pass through it.
They'll need gas masks. What else does it say about it before and after that passage?
Edom's streams will be turned into pitch. Her dust will into burning sulfur. Her land will become blazing pitch.
So the land will just become this sticky, burning substance. If you want to get a drink, the water fountain, that too. It's like, have a drink of napalm. Is there anything else?
In 11 it says, the desert owl and the screech owl will possess it. The great owl and the raven will nest there. God will stretch out over Edom the measuring line of chaos and the plumb line of desolation.
So it's a good place to bring up your little ones. We could play that game. We look at the verses before the apocalyptic passage, we look at the verses after, and we ask, how could this be literally? Literally, it couldn't. A situation like that, there would be no life.
I think also just these ideas of the destruction of the people who had received the mark and participated fully in the economic life, it's also a full participation in social life. And it is reflected by what we've talked about in previous classes, that in Revelation, the people who are, they have the mark on their foreheads, they're sealed for the Lamb. These people on one side, they're all safe. But if you're not in that camp, you will suffer the wrath of God and you will suffer judgment. And so this idea of being so separate, it's reflective of their reality that they live, their lived reality. It's the fact that if you are not part of the emperor worship, if you're not joining in, you're suffering economically and threatened economically, you're suffering socially and threatened socially. Oftentimes, if you were not the head of your family, if you were not the patriarch, the oldest male, then you could be kicked out of the family. And you have no recourse to any resources. Unless somebody feeds you, you've got nothing to eat. You have nowhere to live unless somebody takes you in. I mean, and in this type of world, we can see the way that this reflection with the wrath is interplaying with their actual experience that they live.
All right. Let's continue in verse 12. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. Whatever this is, we're going to have to be on our toes. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, said the Spirit, that they may rest from the labors, for their deeds follow them. What is this kind of form called? Jesus has eight of them in Matthew and four in Luke.
Beatitude.
It's a beatitude. Mm-hmm. Revelation has seven beatitudes. And he's not talking about freedom from death. He's blessed are those who Lord, and blessed are those in the Lord who die. People will be dying. Yeah, but isn't God on our side? Yes. Doesn't mean you won't die. He looks, he sees a white cloud, a man seated on it, like a son of man, golden crown on his head, sharp sickle on his hand. Who does that make us think of? And he's harvesting. And another angel comes out, and he's harvesting. And they're harvesting grapes. And at the end of that grape harvest section, the juice is running through the streets. Could someone read verse 20?
And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia.
Thank you. And how high is 1,600 stadia?
180 miles.
So the water as high as a horse's bridle for
200
miles. Now that's probably more blood than there were horses on the planet. But it's exaggeration. If exaggeration bothers you, it's okay, just call it hyperbole. It's a literary device, which is accepted. Oh. You don't think you can accept it, then you can say greatly overstated, incorrectly estimated, lack of
figurative language. Mm-hmm. Huh? Figurative language.
That's right.
Figurative language. You can do that. But it is quite a judgment. In the Crusades, they had similar judgments with the blood coming up really high, like you could have swimming lessons in it. Okay. John, should we go to 15?
Yes, we shall.
I saw another sign in heaven, great and amazing. Seven angels, seven plagues, which are the last. For with them the wrath of God is finished. And I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass mingled with fire. Those who had conquered the beast and its image and the number of its name, standing beside the sea of the glass with harps of God in their hands. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God. And the song of the Lamb saying, and then we have words. It's a special kind of song. That's good, because there's a lot of blood and murder and torture. So now we're having a happy moment. A song. What do you know about the song?
Worship. It's the song of the faithful.
The faithful, but the Lamb? Wouldn't that refer to Christ?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Moses, the Old Testament, and Christ is a lamb and a lion. These two are being put together into a celebration song. And it's interesting to Exodus. In Exodus, you have all these plagues in chapter 14. And then in chapter 15, you have the song that everyone sings. Mm-hmm. So parallel here, mm-hmm. chapter 14, chapter 15. After this, I looked and I saw the sanctuary of the tent of witness in heaven. And opened, and out of the sanctuary came the seven angels with the seven plagues, clothed with pure, bright linen, with gold sashes around their chests. And one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God who lives forever and ever. And when the sanctuary was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no one could enter the sanctuary until the seven plagues of the seven angels were finished, well, then I heard a loud voice. Now, what's going on in this passage? They sing the song. There's a glimpse into the tent of witness, into the tabernacle in heaven. There's a lot of activity up there. The sanctuary is filled with smoke. No one can get into it until the seven plagues are finished.
Sounds like preparation for judgment.
Preparation. And then I heard a loud voice from the temple, we're in chapter 16 now, telling the seven angels, go and pour out on the earth the seven bowls of God's wrath. So now it's going to get really bad. You know, we have trumpets, we have
seals.
Yeah, seals, we've got bowls. And a lot of these kind of relate to the plagues in Exodus, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Not in a very strict way, but they're recognizable. Painful sores on the people who had the mark of the beast. Do you have any painful sores on you right now in this room? You just might. But don't worry, you're not cursed by God. Okay. The second one, the blood of the sea becomes like a corpse. Everything that dies, everything in the sea dies. Well, that's like the first plague of the Egyptians, isn't it? By Moses. The third, the bowl goes in rivers and springs of water and they became blood. This is driving the nation to its ground. The fourth one puts a bowl on the sun, and people get scorched with fire, scorched by the fierce heat, and they curse God. The fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast. Its kingdom is plunged into darkness, and people can't find their tongues anymore, so they just chew whatever they can find. They gnaw their tongues in anguish and curse God for their pain and sores, and they did not repent of their deeds. The sixth one poured out his bowl on the Euphrates. That's the river that doesn't dry up. But this time it does dry up. And there's a little war. They're the bad guys. And they're going to cross over and fight God's people. And this idea of a war in the last days, you can read about it in Psalms, and you can read about it in Joel and Zechariah or Ezekiel 38-39. And there's going to be a war. And you better stay awake. These are the dominant images here. I wonder, is there actually going to be a war at the end of time? Or is this just talking about, generally speaking, at the end of time, good will triumph over evil? John, hey, what would you say was a standard view among the major groups of Jews approaching the time of Christ? Will there be a last war?
Standard view among the groups of Jews, I mean, that it's not necessarily a last war, but there's going to be a triumph of an earthly Messiah. And will that be a war that precedes the triumph of the earthly Messiah, restoring the kingdom? For most of them, there will be violence, there will be battles, there will be destruction. But a war on this scale, at the end of time, that's most prominently a view that's associated with the Qumran texts, oftentimes paired with a sectarian group of Jews called the Essenes. There is going to be a great war, and everybody's either on the side of darkness or the side of light. And in their view, they were the sons of light, and everybody else was the sons of darkness. And there would be a great war.
So there are a lot of Jewish groups who had thought about a kind of war. They took Mog and Magog of Ezekiel somewhat literally.
Yes.
That there would be a literal war. Whereas I would think not to take it literally. If I turn on my CNN app or my BBC app in the morning and I say, oh, Putin's doing this again, and oh, this crash over here, this is no good, I'm thinking, well, it'll have spiritual applications. The event doesn't matter so much, it's what we make of it. So I mean, I could spiritualize away everything. I suppose a guy at the other side could literalize everything. I get the feeling that these ancient Christians were somewhere more in the middle. They might think I wasn't totally awake to reality. We might think that they were over-interpreting things, being a bit superstitious and need to trim down some of their methods. I don't know. So we continue. Well, he says things like, you know, the sixth angel pours out on his bowl, and you've got demonic spirits performing signs who go abroad to the whole world to assemble them for battle on the great day of the God Almighty. And again, he says, blessed, I'm coming like a thief. Blessed is one who stays awake, keeping his garments on, that they may not go about and be seen naked. And they assembled them at the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon. When we hear the word Armageddon, there are a few images that normally come to mind. Judgment Day, nuclear disaster, the Earth being hit by an asteroid, something really bad happening with aliens, extraterrestrials. Is there another Armageddon I'm mentioning in pop culture? Maybe those are the major categories. I don't know. You think of one? And it's kind of exciting. You're thinking there's going to be this war. Man. But there is a battle. It's mentioned Revelation 16 and 19 and 20. You find this battle written in Ezekiel and Joel and Zechariah and Psalms and lots of places outside the biblical texts. And if a lot of familiar biblical battles in the Bible took place here. Here at Armageddon. Deborah and Barak, that battle. Where Jael and Sisera had that breakfast in bed. Gideon and the Midianites. Pharaoh Necho takes care of Josiah in 609. Josiah, who's confident that he'll be okay. Saul is defeated by the Philistines on Mount Gilboa. I count 22, maybe 24 battles that took place right at Armageddon. So Armageddon's
Armageddon
place.
Known by another name then?
Two places. It's known by Har-Megiddo and Armageddon. Har-Megiddo is the hill or mountain of Megiddo. And so it's a place. It's a village. It's under heavy excavation. And you can visit it as a tourist. I've been to Armageddon maybe five or six times. And it's not some mythical place, it's a real place.
Right.
And you can go there.
I thought it was an event. I didn't realize it was a place.
Well, it's an event too. But when you have an event that happens in a place over and over and over, then it stops being just an event in a place. It starts to take on symbolism. What is going on? If you're really interested, at my website, you would search under the word Armageddon. You can see a list of the 24 battles of Armageddon. And you can be prepared. Well, most of them are in the future, but you can be prepared for the past ones too if you want. Yeah, Mary.
Well, I was on your site, Doug, earlier, and I was not aware of this, but you mentioned something about Jesus being, some people thought that like Jesus was Venus, or something about the morning star, and it's also called the evening star. Back when he was addressing the middle church, and we were to being pressured to tolerate in our society now. You talk just a moment about Jesus and the Venus, and I was just thinking that, you know, in this battle of Armageddon, you know, where Jesus is saying that he's coming soon and everything, that that I don't know, but I was just, I guess I just kind of got excited and thinking that Venus, you know, it would be so fabulous when Christ came, you know, for it to be like Venus, you know, like that morning star, you know, coming with his army, you know, just imagine how fabulous it would be, you know. I'm sorry, but does that make sense? I mean, with all that tragedy and all that, you know, we would have, the people would have endured up to that point, and to see that you know, planets do and stars do, they burn out and they move, and and I was, do you right. see what I'm
so there's hope. This is a very glum situation, and he says, and I'm going to give you the morning star. The
yes.
morning star is Jesus.
Yes.
And so Jesus is approaching, and he's getting brighter and brighter and brighter.
Yes.
I mean, Venus is almost the size of the Earth anyway.
Yes.
Way bigger than the Moon. And so these motions in the astronomical bodies can send messages, and they can give hope, or they can remove hope. And that is the way we would think about it. And back then, they had a different astronomy. For them, Venus was not quite as impressive. As it got closer and closer, it would be impressive. They would have no idea how much bigger it is, even than the Moon, which they thought was the second biggest thing up in the sky. So it's fine to think this way, to feel this way. These are the things that were happening. The result of this, so you have this showdown, and it's funny because even the Muslims today think that there's going to be an Armageddon kind of battle in the Middle East in a place called Dibuk, and they... the ones who take it literally are getting prepared, just like people who take it literally in Georgia are getting underground bunkers and canned goods and loading up on ammo and so forth. The seventh angel pours his bowl into the air, and the message comes out, it is done. This is the seventh bowl. Now we're at the climax. And it's noisy. Flashes of lightning, rumbling, peals of thunder. There's a great earthquake. Wow. The great city split three-way. The cities of the nations fell. God remembered Babylon the Great, Rome, to make her drain the cup of the wine of the fury of his wrath. Every island fled away. No mountains were to be found. This is like Isaiah chapter 2. Great hailstones, not 1 pound each, which would kill you, 100 pounds each, fell from heaven on people because they cursed, and they cursed God for the plague of hail because the plague was so severe. This is an image that, remember, it's painting with ideas. We're painting on the canvas here, not with statements of philosophical truth. We're painting with pictures which convey ideas. We need to have our hearts open. Let me just mention a couple of misconceptions about Revelation before we prepare to let you go. One is, there's so many viewpoints about this Battle of Armageddon. So which side will have the cruise missiles? Which side will have the neutron bombs? Now, if the Chinese are crossing the Euphrates, who will be their allies? Will Kazakhstan be working with them? Who else would join the Chinese? The North Koreans are reaching out to them right now. And what kind of nukes will they have? Okay, the kinds of weapons described in Revelation are ancient weapons. It's like arrows and bows, and maybe a biting locust. And you can say, yeah, but that's a kind of helicopter. You haven't proved to me that that's a kind of helicopter. What kind of sword does Jesus carry?
Flaming.
What is Jesus carrying in his mouth?
The word.
A text. In his mouth, he's got a sharp, double-edged sword. which is the word of God.
Right.
That's in 116, 212, 216, 1915, 1921. So he's in the battle, but he has a message. You know, Jesus isn't holding on to some anti-aircraft gun.
Right.
He's got a message coming out of his mouth. Right. Not the way wars are normally fought. Also, we should remember that God and Satan, when it comes to battles, they're never equally balanced.
Right.
In the Persian religion of this time, before the Muslims came, the good guy and the bad guy were equally balanced. You know, Agrimann was the bad guy, and he was as powerful as the good guy, Ahura Mazda. So Mazda had this power, and Agrimann had this power, and really it could go either way. You know, just blow on it and you can tilt the course of eternity, make it go that way. There is a balance. That's called dualism, because there are two powers. First, you might say, oh, Christianity is dualistic. We have two powers. Yeah, but it's not like that. There are two powers. But it's more like, here's the devil and here's God. What happens when you put God just down on the devil's weight? Like that. I mean, come on, God's a million times more powerful than the devil.
Amen.
It's not like it's close. It's not even slightly close.
Right.
If you're fooled by it, you're oppressed by the devil.
Mm-hmm.
It tells us something about you. It doesn't tell us anything about right. the difference between them.
Mm.
The difference is amazing. And the third general principle is that things may get worse before they get better.
Mm.
Whether the worse culminates in an actual battle or not, maybe there will be an actual battle. Maybe ISIS is part of God's plans for our planet. I don't know. I can't disprove it. I can't prove it. Maybe. But if things get worse in that way before they get better, perhaps it's something you can settle from Revelation. And I hope you'll keep studying. We can't offer you that kind of certainty in the class that John and I have put together. These are just some concluding things to remember. Things may get worse before they get better. That's always a principle in Revelation. God and Satan are no way equally balanced. It's not even close. And the warfare of Christ, the kinds of weapon we do wage war as Paul said in 2 Corinthians 10, yes, are not the weapons of the world.
Right.
And you get that all twisted up, then you have bad theology and bad politics, mm-hmm, and bad economics. We need to really put our faith in God.
Right.
I think a lot of this, we talk about physical battles, but there's a huge spiritual battle that I see a lot more. I'm sure they saw it themselves, but it's like, even this day and age, the amount of things and abilities that draw people away from God, or things happen, and people do curse God and say, well, why does God let this happen? I think that same type of mindset was back then as well, but it's just, it is a battle, but it's in a different level.
Okay.
I have a quick question about chapter 16. In verse 15 of my Bible, it's in red letters.
Mm.
But usually when it's in red letters, there's a preface or a prequel that says, Jesus said, or he said, or something like that. It's not in this, so is that kind of like, we're assuming Jesus said it, or they just mistakenly printed it in red letters?
It's in the preface of your Bible.
Okay. That.
It'll lay out how they decided.
How they decided that specific verse?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so red letters were added about 150 years ago. Because we believe the whole Bible is from Jesus.
Right.
But they want to narrow it down to words he actually said. Mm-hmm. They want to make it simple. But they normally explain their method in the beginning.
Right, no. What I'm asking is are we to assume that verse 15 came from the lips of Jesus?
You should assume that the translators, the majority of the translators, thought that
those words
came from the lips of Jesus and therefore needed a bit of color on it.
Probably they were thinking, who else would say, I am coming like a thief in the night?
Okay.
And drawing on gospel traditions and the parables about these types of things. That's probably how the majority of them got that way, to that position.
You know, Thomas Jefferson did exactly what you just said. He made his own Bible by just taking words that Jesus said and making his own little book, and that's what he read. He didn't even look at the rest. He didn't think it was worth looking at.
You all know that, right?
Yeah. If you can follow that, you're doing pretty good.
Jefferson edited the New Testament, removing all the miraculous.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Well, I didn't know about that part. I knew he just took only the words of Jesus. Everything else was editorializing.
It was a pretty popular view at his time to remove all the miraculous.
Well, next time, the deceit of politics and wealth and the power of heaven as we plow on in chapter 17. That will be fun.